The following is a paid presentation. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the staff and management of Shiawassee Radio.
This is your cell. This is your bunk.
This is the Jail Visit on Shiawassee Radio, live from the Cofield Oil and Propane Studios. Here's attorney Bill Amadeo.
All right, I'm Bill Amadeo from McManus and Amadeo and Grable and Associates. Oh my god. Oh. Child prep struggle is real, guys. I gotta tell you. I told somebody tonight, every case I take, I have to believe is going to trial. Now, it doesn't always happen like that, but that's your mindset. And that fight can be exhausting. I will just lay that out there. Because what I've learned in this profession, it doesn't matter what's going on with your personal life. Doesn't matter if you got COVID or a cold. It doesn't matter if your kid is sick or your dog's depressed. The docket just keeps rolling, and they say the show must go on. And I've experienced so much drama in my career already, I tell you. And, you know, I know people think I'm crazy. Like, I heard somebody say, you must be a drinker or use drugs because you're up all night working. No, this is sober. I got, this is close I get to alcohol, man. This is a green Gatorade. I don't even do energy drinks much anymore. You know, back in the day, when I say back in the day, like 2015, my blood pressure was really high. What's up, Ed Pruitt? And I was drinking like a lot of Red Bull. So now I do like these healthy energy drinks maybe a couple times a week. But I got so turned off by energy drinks. It's like false energy. And I'm just... The two workouts a day is really good for mental stability. But let me stop right now. You guys did not tune in to hear about my mental instability. Let's talk about three things tonight. Number one, we're going to hit the interlocutory appeal. I'm going to explain what that is, why you use it, the meaning behind it. Because not everybody knows what an interlocutory appeal is. And I will give a shameless plug to Grable and Associates. And by the way, I have nothing to do with interlocutory appeals. Grable and Associates has Tim Doman doing interlocutory appeals. Or somebody like a David Hertzquitz. They don't want me near their appellate work. I'm the guy that wins trials. I'm not the guy that's a good legal writer. People love my sentencing memos because I'm writing a story. It's like journalism all over again. Thank God. But legal writing, yeah. We'll talk about that. We will discuss the Clueless soundtrack from 1995, movie from our youth. Then I'm going to have an athletic announcement. In fact, we will do the athletic announcement after the interlocutory appeal. Let's hit that appeal. So what I'm trying to do now, just so everybody's, you know, paying attention, I'm going to do one legal aspect, one comical aspect, and one reflective aspect in each one of these lives. Of course, I will change, like the weather, but that's the plan right now. We'll see if the plan works. We're at a trial once. I planned this thing out so meticulous for so long. And then I got the trial, and I changed everything on the fly, and we won. So I don't know. I think sometimes you over-prepare to just be yourself. And it doesn't matter, but I mean, that's just the process. So this is our process. We're going to go law. We're going to go reflection. We're going to go humor. Let's talk law. Interlocutory appeal. Okay, as a defense lawyer, you should try to win trials and you will lose motions. And you cannot take it personal when a judge rules against your motion. When you write a motion, you're doing it for a couple reasons. One, you're doing it to preserve an appellate issue. Because part of your job as a defense lawyer is not just to win the case, but it's to preserve appellate issues. So God forbid if a guilty verdict comes out, you give your client another bite of the apple. A strong defense lawyer knows to create appellate issues. But you gotta understand, it's frustrating in criminal law, because the best of us will lose motions on a regular basis. I have lost some motions which made no sense to me. Like, how could this judge rule against my motion? And you understand something. The judges take on the law, it might be incorrect.
your view might be incorrect, but what you have to do to key to emotions, it's like the bar exam where I say issue spotting is key. Whether you're a great motion writer or a lousy motion writer, the key to emotion in preserving the constitutional rights of your client is to issue spot properly. Find the issue, preserve it, seal it. What you're doing with all that work, of course you're trying to get the case dismissed in the pretrial, but you're also providing your client with an insurance policy. And an interlocutory appeal takes it to the next level. Here's my shout out to Grable and Associates on this. An interlogatory appeal, a lot of people don't even know what that means. That is an appeal before you get to trial. Here's what I mean in its most simplistic terms. You file a motion in our circuit courts. The circuit court judge declines your motion. You ask for a stay. They will deny the stay generally. You file at the Court of Appeals for immediate consideration. If the Court of Appeals denies it, then you try to kick it up to the Michigan Supreme Court. If the Michigan Supreme Court denies it, you try to kick it to the federal court. But what you're doing with an interlocutory appeal, it's like intervening. That's where the term comes from. The term interlock, and everything comes back to Latin phrases and such, but the term interlock, think about this. Inner means it comes in the middle. Locks means it stays the proceedings. So the interlocutory appeal is trying to get the reviewing court to say to the circuit court, hey guys, you got it wrong. Sometimes the problem at the Court of Appeals is what panel you get. One panel could see things your way, another panel could see things another way. And then sometimes, we've had this happen on a couple cases, we'll file an interlocutory appeal. The Court of Appeals will deny it. We kick it up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court then could say, you know what? I see merit here. They remand it back down to the Court of Appeals, who may deny it again, and then you go up to the Michigan Supreme Court for your oral argument. There's different functions. You understand the court system. District court is where things start. Circuit court is where the Super Bowl's played. But the interlocutory appeals at the Court of Appeals, the Michigan Supreme Court, they are different layers of the game. You have to have thin skin as a criminal defense lawyer. I saw this young kid the other day, and she's a talented lawyer. Really is. I like her. I think she's got a bright future. She was crying her eyes out, and I saw her in court, and I said, hey, what's going on? You okay? And she's like, my motions were denied. And I like, kind of shrugged my shoulder. I'm like, hey, come on. Let me buy you a Gatorade. And we went over to the vending machine, and we talked it out, and I'm like, hey, look. The judge she was in front of, this judge is always going to deny these motions. Don't take it personal. Don't feel you did bad work. But she didn't even know what an interlocutory appeal was. She's a kid. She'll catch on. She's going to be good. But when I explained to her the interlocutory appeal, it kind of gave her a ray of hope. And this is somebody who's a young public defender who wants to do the right thing. And I hate to say this because you admire the passion. But when you get to my point of the career, the passion is obviously there, but you also have this thick skin that you almost expect them to deny a motion, and you know you're just moving to the next step. It's almost like, okay, you punched me in the face, but you didn't knock me out. I'll see you next round. It's hard for some lawyers to comprehend that concept. In this business, you are going to get punched in the face. It's going to happen. It's like when Rocky said to his son, Rocky Balboa, though, it's not how hard you can hit. It's not how hard you hit. It's how hard you can get hit. Keep getting up. I'll post that clip later. It's really inspirational. So the interlocutory appeal is a motion you file in our circuit court. It gets denied. You then take it to the Court of Appeals to try to preserve that issue. They are the reviewing court for the circuit court to try to provide an issue for your client. It could be something as serious as a motion to quash, which would be a dismissal. It could be a missing evidence instruction. It could be a standaway motion. Don't get me started on standaway motions. I could talk all night about standaway motions. Some of the rulings I've had from judges some of the things they have said about Steinway motions and how I'm wrong with my interpretation. It's like, See you at the Court of Appeals. And guys, this is not personal. Remember that, alright? When a judge rules against you, don't hate the judge. But the judge shouldn't hate you when you try to override their decision. Our job. I am actually arguing a couple of appellate cases, Nancy, but I didn't write them. Keep that in mind so people get the joke. Our job is simply to advocate to the greatest extent of the law for our client. And sadly, in this journey, there will be bumps along the way. You lose motions, you win trials. Keep that in mind. Now, I have a huge announcement to make. I didn't want to say this because I was trying to keep it in, but I'm pretty excited to announce that I have not one, not two, but I have 3 years of eligibility left for college baseball. I know, right? I can tell you right now, the Division I schools are pumped up for a 47-year-old criminal defense lawyer to be their new closer. I want to throw a few things out there. I can throw a fastball 78 miles an hour. That is faster than Scott Grable could throw one. I have a changeup, which is about 65. I throw better sidearm. And my last season of slow pitch softball, I hit 900. Now, I know what you're thinking. This is exciting, right? A lot of schools will be very interested in my services. I am available. I got to work around my 70-hour work week and the family and all that. But if you are interested in giving me a Division I scholarship, and guys, this is not like the lawyer who goes gets an LMM not to pay their financial aid. I know. It's a cool wee joke there. I have 3 years of college eligibility left to play on your baseball team. And I'm excited, damn it. I could also return kicks and punts, if you like, on your football team. And Adam's son's very impressed with my progress in the gym, so I'm ready to play Division I ball. I'm so inspired by Rudy in these 7 years of eligibility. Okay. Hey, guy, how's it going? Glad things are going well for you, man. So, I'm going to end tonight on the Clueless soundtrack. Remember Clueless from 1995? Oh, my God. I remember going to the movie with Q and Scott Zolber. We were kids. We were freshmen in college. God, it feels like a lifetime ago. But the soundtrack spoke to me, and it's one of those soundtracks that when you listen to it at 19, thank you, Nancy, it's so much different at 47. But I want to talk about how I always found Clueless to be an amazing soundtrack, but also a very heart-wrenching soundtrack. And it's weird how it ages with you, you know? You see things so differently. When you bought the album in 1995... it's like, it was cool, you were slipping your CD in your car, and you had your system, and you were blasting it. But you know, tonight I'm coming back to the office, and Spotify, it's like they read your mind. It's like, hey, subconsciously, I know what you're thinking, dude. You want to listen to Clueless soundtrack tonight. And there's three songs that hit me so goddamn hard, and I have been in, like, forums discussing meanings of songs. It's usually, like, you know, when you're heavy in trial prep and I'm like, my mental stability is really limited. Like, less limited than the night. But, I hate how people misinterpret an artist. God, it frustrates the shit out of me. I'm going to discuss three songs from Clueless. The first song is Ghost in You by The Counting Crows. Now, if you know me, I love The Counting Crows. The song Round Here was so meaningful to kids from Ducktown. But Ghost in You, listen to the lyrics. I will post these three songs later. I promise I'll do that. I will post that and Rocky's speech to his son. But Ghostie, what he's talking about is he can't shake this girl. He's in love with her. She's not in love with him. And he cannot shake her. And it's breaking him up inside. And if you listen to the lyrics, they're very powerful. And the Counting Crows, they were always a moody band. And when I say a moody band, they were excellent. But their personalities, you know, they were different. And this song is really pouring his heart out. I hear you, Nancy. We all need a trial prep playlist. And Ghost in You, I always saw it as the one that got away is what he's saying. I hear people have these horrible interpretations of the song. It's a great song, right? God. I mean, how passionate is he pouring his heart into the song? And he knows, he's saying, I'm never going to get her. It's over, but I can't forget her. That is what he's saying in Ghost in You. And when I hear these different idiots say, oh yeah, he's saying how things are going to be great. No! He's saying things fell apart. He's saying it's over. He's saying she chose somebody over him. He's literally pouring his heart out. And pop culture missed the mark on it. Song deserved more. Fake Plastic Trees was the second song by Radiohead. Alright, so listen. The general consensus on this song is it's about a girl he was in love with that got a boob job. No! It's about a girl he was in love with that left him for a guy with more money. Listen to the goddamn lyrics. And, you know, it's so weird because this movie, Clueless, about high school kids, for Christ's sake, and the cliques in high school, but the soundtrack is about heartbreaking social events. Fake Plastic Trees by Radiohead was completely, it missed the mark. Society missed the mark on it. He lost her to a guy because the other guy had more money. What poor kid cannot relate to that? Jesus Christ. And the last one was my forgotten favorite by Velocity Girl. It's towards the end, right? It's like the next to last song. And this song, she's yapping about, and I'm saying she's yapping because it's like kind of a scat to it. I shouldn't have left that person, but I did. Every one of those three songs was about lost love in some way, shape, or form. And the thing about music that's so powerful was we all put our own interpretation to it, right? But my God, Ghost in You, Fake Plastic Trees, and my forgotten favorite. For those three songs to be, in my opinion, the centerpiece of the Clueless soundtrack, it's deeper than people realize. I think it takes you 30 years to finally catch on to what was happening. It was ahead of its time. All right, been a long day. Guys, kick some ass, take some names.
The Jail Visit with attorney Bill Amadeo from McManus and Amadeo. Connect with McManus and Amadeo at McManusAmadeo.com or call 800-392-7311. This is The Jail Visit on Shiawassee Radio.
We're going to talk about bond motions. College hoops memories from the hood. And a crazy phone call that just didn't it lasted way too long. I swear, there's been dysfunction around me for so long. Oh, God. But I know some people hit me up about today's hearing in Lenawee. And they asked me to discuss the Daubert hearing. Okay, let me explain this. Thank you, Joe. How's it going, Joe? We had a productive text earlier. Rock and roll, baby, right? I love Joe Abera. Got your back, man. I know the opposing counsel wanted an expert in without a Daubert hearing. Holy shit. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. I mean, my God. I know Cooley supposedly sucked, but where did some of these guys get their law degree? At Kmart or something? Jesus. It frustrates me that I'm usually the smartest person in the room, because I gotta tell you, there's a lot of dysfunction here, but holy shit, can you read? I can't stand that lawyer. I just... Oh, God. If I had any hair left, I'd just pull it out. All right. Let's get down to business. Bond hearings. Got a new Instagram person looking for some content, so I got to start doing more content. And by the way, I've been working since like 7 o'clock this morning with two lifts in between, so my weirdness factor is at an 11. That's higher than 10. Let's talk about the bond motion. Arraignments and bond motions are two things. We're going to start professional, then we'll dig into personal, then we'll get into comedy. We'll try to do the whole tripolar thing tonight. When you arraign somebody, your goal is to get the lowest possible bond, because it is much easier to advocate for someone who is not remanded to the county jail. So, you have to argue for bond. What you should do to save the magistrate's time is something like this. William Amadeo, P76194 for Joe Smith. We both appear here. Joe, state your name for the magistrate and their staff. Defense will waive a formal reading of the charges, stand mute, and like to be heard on bond when appropriate. That right there is your script, okay? What you did is you saved the magistrate time. You didn't ask for a formal reading, and it's showing a few things. Number one, I know what my client's charged with, and I'm here to fight, respectfully. Number two, we're all about judicial economy. Number three, I'm going to tell you what my guy or girl deserves, a PR bond. A PR bond is a personal recognizance bond, and that means you're on the honor code. If you get a $10,000 PR bond, that means you don't pay a dime unless you violate bond. So what you want to do is get your client that PR bond when possible. How do you dig into that? Well, there's two huge aspects. If we turn to the bond factors, there's a number of them, but there's really two that magistrates and district court judges hinge on. The two factors you have to hit hard is, number one, is my client a flight risk? Number two, are they a danger to the community? Let's isolate, okay? Flight risk. If they have a retained lawyer, that is showing the court that they... Thanks, Mike. I appreciate it. It is 2,200 hours. Let's rock and roll. They have a retained lawyer. They're not going to fly. Why are they going to leave? Why would I hire a lawyer if I was going to flee the county? That helps settle that. Here's where it comes to number two. Here's your critical factor. Are they a danger to the community? Now, you have to look at the charge itself. You have to stress to the magistrate, this is just a charge. And it may look bad on paper. There's a lot to unravel. We look at their prior criminal history. We could look at scoring guidelines. We want to get really detailed with things. As charge, this is their scoring guidelines. And you say as charge because usually if you're going to end up in a plea, it's not going to be as charge. But every case you take, young lawyers, you got to say to yourself, this is going to go to trial. Obviously, there's room for resolution at times, but you got to have that mindset, I'm ready for war. This person hired me to win this case at trial. And this is why you want to give me that PR bond. This is why that charge is not as bad on paper. Maybe they're HIDA eligible. Maybe they're 7411 eligible. You have to get intimate with the defendant's complaint and their personal history. You know, have they ever been accused of anything before? Do they have ties to the community? Do they have a job? Do they have a husband? Do they have a wife? Do they have children? You are giving a 3 to 5 minute biography on why your client, who you are standing next to, should not go into their own pocket to fight this case. Now, understand something. With certain district court judges, if you run a preliminary examination, you do run the risk of having bond revoked, having bond heightened, having charges heightened. You need to know the pulse of the court. There are some counties when you should always run a preliminary examination. There are other counties where you should waive that preliminary examination. And there are some counties where the prosecutor will run the prelim themselves to preserve testimony. And when you have the dual county situation, the dual county situation is when your client has been charged in multiple counties at the same time. If one prosecutor decides to run the prelim, then you have to run both because you're going to build inconsistent testimony. You have to watch when the district court judge is flexing their muscle and raising bond. You have to know who your district court judge is. Because all that beautiful bond argument you just made could be pissed away with a prelim, but sometimes you got to lock something in that preliminary examination. And I don't care who the lawyer is, whether it's Bill Amadeo or Joe fucking Smith, depending upon the pulse of that court will dictate the risk of bond being revoked or heightened. You have to know the pulse of your court. Sometimes you may find out that an officer destroyed evidence and that's why you ran the prelim. Anyway, know your bonds. Now, now that we got that out of the way, let's talk about North Carolina State. It is so good to see the Wolfpack back in the Final Four. I'm going to tell you a story about Willow Avenue. Willow Avenue, where I grew up in Ducktown. And, you know, we were welfare children. We were very poor back then. And back then, we had 12 channels. And Channel 8 was ESPN. And there were three college teams we got to watch. And I don't know why we got to watch those three college teams, but ESPN in South Jersey, circa 1983 to 1990, played Villanova, Maryland, and North Carolina State. Villanova makes sense. That was the closest team based upon geography. North Carolina State and Maryland were ACC teams, so that didn't really quite make as much sense. Maryland has some geographic ties to Atlantic City, but they were the teams we watched. And one of my first memories is North Carolina State in 1983. I'm like 6 years old, beating Phi Slamma Jamma. Phi Slamma Jamma, the University of Houston, they were one of the greatest college basketball teams on paper. And Jimmy Valvano, the young Italian coach, we'll get to why that's important in a moment, he caught lightning in a bottle. And the North Carolina State team, which did not stand a chance, won it all. Known as one of the greatest upsets in the history of college basketball. And what this win meant for my family, who were poor Italians living in the hood, was that Jimmy Valvano was held on a pedestal. And he met on that pedestal 2 years later when Rolly Massimino led the Villanova team over Georgetown. That's a story for another time. But I remember my aunt, my grandfather, sitting in the living room with me, and we're watching North Carolina State defeat Houston. And I saw my family cry. And they said, remember, Billy, you could do anything in this world, and look at Jimmy V. And Jim Valvano became like this icon in my house. He was such a relatable guy. You know, and eventually he dies of cancer. He gives that speech, don't give up, don't ever give up. Jimmy Valvano, I felt like he was a member of our family. And watching North Carolina State this weekend defeat Duke, wow. On paper, Duke is a superior team. In fact, on paper, this North Carolina State team should have lost every game in the tournament so far, but here they are at the Final Four. And look, I don't know if they'll beat Purdue. I don't know if they'll beat Alabama or Connecticut, depending on who wins that game, but they made it to the Final Four. They exceed expectations. And what you take from that is sometimes what looks good on paper could kiss your ass. I feel like the spirit of Jim Valvano is with this North Carolina State team. I got the visual of my aunt making him a big, big bowl of spaghetti and meatballs and watching this game. My aunt, my mom, my grandfather, and Jim Valvano in this vision are just watching North Carolina State shock the world. It's a lot of good memories. And, you know, it's been crazy with work. Things have been rough, you know. Successful, but rough. Exhausted. But I escaped into watching North Carolina State this weekend and just, I felt like, wow, this could really be a team of destiny. And it brought back those memories of being poor in Willow Avenue and only having 12 channels, but being connected. And that's, I'm really happy for North Carolina State. Let's end this with the crazy phone calls. How many people have gotten crazy phone calls in their life? Yeah. So, one of my guilty pleasures in life, what I do to go to sleep at night is I listen to old wrestling podcasts. I love hearing about wrestling from the 80s and 70s and the stories behind the scenes. You know, Joe Abair and Adam Cartwright, guys are still wrestling fans today. I'm not. I just cannot relate to today's product. But the wrestling from when we were children, my God, that still speaks to me. The storylines. And there was a promoter in New Jersey named Dennis Curluzzo. And Dennis Curluzzo was friends with Jim Cornette, the famous Jim Cornette. Jim Cornette, who is arguably the greatest manager in the history of wrestling, I feel second behind Bobby the Brain Heenan. And Curluzzo is a small-town promoter in New Jersey, and he becomes friends with Jim Cornette. And one day, and understand something, may he rest in peace, but Dennis Curluzzo had a few screws loose. And having screws loose really is something I relate to tonight. When I thought back, when I listened to that podcast last night. So Dennis calls his friend Jim Cornette in Tennessee. And he says, oh, hi, can I speak to Jim, please? And this old woman named Mrs. Spencer picks up the phone. And she starts screaming and cursing at him. You asshole! Nobody named Jim lives here! And this woman is ranting and raving for like 10 minutes. Now, you or I may say, okay, wrong number. That person's crazy. But Dennis Curluzzo himself was also a little crazy. So what Dennis Curluzzo did to get even with Mrs. Spencer was he wrote down the number to Mrs. Spencer, and for years he had friends call this number and keep asking for Jim. And then what they did was they started recording the calls to Jim, and I'll post a recording later. They did a podcast on it. And this woman would scream at these people, hi, is Jim there? Fuck you! My God! And it brought me back to a call from when I was in 8th grade. Actually, I was in 7th grade. I'm in 7th grade, and there is this girl who's a year older. I won't say her name, because she probably stalks my profile anyway. And she's probably crazier today than she was when we were children, but okay. She calls me one day. And let me back it up. There was a kid I grew up with named Michael Chait. Mike Chait could never stand me. Feeling was mutual. And I never knew what Mike Chait's problem was with me, but I mean, let me just say this about Mike. In my opinion, Mike's face could stop a clock. This was just an ugly child. And Mike, if you're watching, you know you weren't good looking, right? Okay, let's just... I'm sorry. And this girl, she calls me. A very pretty girl, and I'm in 7th grade, and I'm somewhat excited about it. And she goes, hey, is this Billy? I'm like, yeah. She goes, did you call me? I said, no. She goes, well, do you know who I am? I said, oh, yeah, I know who you are. Very popular girl from 8th grade. So she says, okay, I believe you didn't call me. But let me tell you something. If I find out that you did call me, I'm gonna have your ass kicked. Holy shit, let me get this straight. As if life wasn't screwed up enough, this girl, who I believe Mike Chate called and said it was me for whatever reason, whatever Mike got out of that, I mean, you have to ask him. I'm sure he's middle management in New Jersey somewhere. He shouldn't be hard to find. Did I mention I'm really tired? Anyway, so this girl's threatening to have my ass kicked for simply calling her. And I remember this like it was yesterday. And I'm kind of bitter. I'm like, you know what? One day, this girl's going to want me, and I'm not going to call her. And I was right. However, timing is really a problem in life sometimes. Would you agree with that? Yeah. So, out of the blue, a few years later, this girl calls my house again. And she's selling Bibles now. Now, this was weird. She was a good-looking girl a year older who was wild, and now she is selling religious memorabilia. And I guess with all the Trump stuff going on, that seemed a nice segue. But you can imagine me at 16 saying, no, I don't want to buy your Bible. It's okay. This kind of made her irate. And I don't know what they were teaching her in the Bible class, but it reminded me of Mrs. Spencer telling people to go fuck themselves. Fuck you! You don't want to buy a Bible, you son of a bitch! It was very confusing to me. I turned to Father Sullivan, which was never a good idea. And Father Sullivan, always a wise man, said, well, you know, if you're going to spend money on Bibles, you should buy ours. Thank you for solving my problem there. I would then see this girl in college. And she would be out there selling Bibles. And, you know, one day, I'm waiting for a bus at Atlantic Cape Community College. And I don't know why I did this, but she's out there with her Bibles, right? And I said to her, hey, how'd you end up with this whole Bible thing? You know, if there's one thing I've learned in life, you really cannot engage crazy people on what they think is their level. Because I learned so much about this individual, and for some reason, when we moved to Ventnor, she called my house again trying to sell these Bibles. And she was very irate. And I thought that one day at the bus stop, we had a pleasant conversation. Okay, when I was in 7th grade, you were going to have my ass kicked for calling you. Later in high school, you were pissed off I didn't buy your Bibles. We became friendly at community college. Now, years later, we're moved to Ventnor, and she's calling trying to pitch these Bibles again. I'm still saying no. She's telling me to go fuck myself. Father Sullivan's telling me to buy his Bibles. I don't want to buy any Bibles. I don't know. It just, the whole thing got weird. It made me think of Mrs. Spencer and the Dennis Carluza call, how the wrong number led to this whole fuck you thing. I don't know. So, what do we take from tonight? Let's wrap it up. If you're doing a bond motion, self-surrender is a great thing. You enhance it. Hey, Amanda, hope you're doing well, too. Your two arguments are flight risk and danger to the community. College hoops was amazing in the 80s, and I feel revived by that, despite a different place in life. And, prank calls can stick with you a lot longer than you expect if somebody is really not right in the head.
The Jail Visit with attorney Bill Amadeo from McManus and Amadeo. Connect with McManus and Amadeo at McManusAmadeo.com or call 800-392-7311. This is The Jail Visit on Shiawassee Radio.
It's funny. I had somebody contact me earlier. I was texting somebody about a case. And they were like, what are you doing? It's Memorial Day. You know, and I don't quite get that, guys. I think everybody should enjoy their life. I really do. But I really think we're in a society right now where people look for excuses not to work. It's Friday. It's the weekend. It's a holiday. I don't know. My Uncle Sam Ioli, may he rest in peace, an amazing role model to me. He always taught me, you go in the office early on the holidays, and you'll be a step ahead of the competition. And I think most importantly in this profession, our clients are facing the most dire of circumstances. Don't we owe it to them to push the envelope? I mean, I don't know. That's just me. So I decided to come in and been working for a few hours. Did not hit the gym today because the foot's hurting. But I'm grinding away, and I'm sure I'll go home and enjoy the holiday like everybody else, but I don't like excuses not to work. And today's topic is relatively important because these are topics that are completely overlooked. And it's frustrating. Scott Grable, good to see you again. Enjoyed watching Shallow Hal with you. That was good last night. Listen about Inco hate crimes. And speaking of Scott Grable, there'll be an article coming up where the writer actually quotes Scott and myself soon enough, and there'll be a blog attached to this, I guess. But when you look at an Inco hate crime, you're looking at a crime that's punished towards the commission of committing a crime. So let me explain what that means in English. Let's talk about bar exam and law school aspects versus the real world. Inco hate, it often gets accomplished with a Latin term. And when you're on the Michigan bar exam, Latin terms are always incorrect on the MBE multiple choice portion. Never pick a Latin term as an answer. And they often seduce students into picking them. But in the essays, those terms really have a lot of weight. And in law school, the concept of incohate crimes, because they're technically incomplete crimes, if you would, they get overlooked too. Like in your crim law course, maybe week 9 or week 10, depending upon who your professor is, you don't see a ton of them on the exam, but then it comes back to bite you on the bar exam. In the real world, quite often at public defender's office, the guys and girls that are newer get these crimes, and that's kind of dangerous because we're seduced to this feeling that these are not major crimes. They actually are. The three big Inco hate crimes, and there's more than these three. Let's talk about them. Solicitation, attempt, and conspiracy. And they're kind of wicked the way they could go together. Let's break down solicitation. We're going to talk about what the crime is, the elements of the crime, if you would, at least on a broad base, and then how different counties look at that crime. When we look at solicitation, we're thinking to ask, aid, entice, or encourage. And many people think solicitation to prostitution is always where this crime lives. It actually goes a lot deeper than that. There could be solicitation to murder. Solicitation plays a huge role in the drug criminal aspect of things. But let's talk about that. If you ask somebody to commit a crime, technically, you have solicited that. We see this a lot in sting operations. The ghost teams in different counties, especially in Genesee County, they'll try to set people up to come to hotels to meet young girls. And what's happening is the solicitation aspect collides with the entrapment theory. One thing about solicitation that we got to watch out for is the merger doctrine. A lot of times a criminal complaint can be completely compromised because a prosecutor will charge a defendant with solicitation and the principal crime. We say principal crime, think about this for a minute. Solicitation is how it starts, and it merges into the principal or target crime, depending on the verbiage you want to use. You can't be charged with both, technically. Now, a bar exam trick could be that you solicit into one crime, and then you actually get involved in another crime. But solicitation is like the first pitch in the game. Opening tip-off. Use a basketball analogy for game 7 tonight. Many people think about solicitation in the prostitution realm, and I understand why they do. Guys solicit a prostitute for sexual purposes, but it goes a lot deeper than that. And if we're going to talk about prostitution for a minute, you understand a few things. This gets lost on people. In a place like Washtenaw, they've been very clear. They're not going to charge people for prostitution. In a place like Wayne, the solicitation of prostitution actually has a 45-day mandatory minimum sentence if you don't get it down to a disorderly or get the case dismissed. So you got to watch that. You know, it's not a one-size-fits-all. One of the things Pete Winter taught me, and I learned a lot from Pete, but one of the things he told me that was actually extremely valuable is this concept of uniformity of law. What about uniformity of law? The law says this, right? The legislator put these laws into play. What's up, Amber? And what we've learned as we get seasoned in the criminal justice field is that every county puts their own spin on the law. The way solicitation plays out in Lapeer will be a lot different than the way it plays out in Ingham County. You gotta know that. Your lawyer needs to know that going in. But solicitation is that first concept, if you would. Attempt is a much bigger aspect. Because attempt is a failed crime, right? And again, attempt will merge into the principal or target crime. You understand something, though. With intent, the big knock, if you would, the big concept we got to break down, whether it's the bar exam or you're actually a practitioner, is the concept of substantial step. Did you intend to commit the crime, and did you take a substantial step towards the commission of the crime? We look at substantial step, we look at close proximity. How close did you come? And as a failed baseball player, I always go back to the concept of the check swing. And you guys know what the check swing is, right? You went swinging. Did you break your wrist? And you look at the first base umpire if you're a righty, or the third base umpire if you're a lefty, to see if the guy actually swung. Is it a strike? That's the way you look at attempt. You know, attempt at murder is pretty black and white. You shot at somebody you missed. Here's my question for you. Let's say the defendant wanted to kill somebody, and they load their gun, and they get into their car, then they have a change of heart, and they drive home. Is that attempt? Let's take a pop culture analogy on it. Let's go back to Boys in the Hood. Great movie, right? If you ever watch Boys in the Hood, there's a horrible but powerful scene when Ricky gets killed. And Trey is heartbroken, right? Trey is devastated. His best friend just got shot for no reason. And this kid leaves behind his girlfriend and his child. And we find out that day he gets in the USC with football. And there is this black cloud over everything. And Doughboy and his boys want to go kill the guys that killed Ricky. Trey gets in the car, and they start driving, looking for these guys. Let's isolate Trey for a minute. Did Trey have the intent to kill for revenge for Ricky? Element's there, right? That intent, that mens rea, that's present. The question I have for you guys, and the question a prosecutor would have, a defense counsel would battle over, is Trey getting in the car with the intent and driving around looking for the killer of Ricky, is that enough to say he's guilty of attempted murder? Did he take a substantial step? Now, in the movie, Trey jumps out, right? He takes a bus and he goes home. They find the people that killed Ricky at the mall. How close was Trey getting out of the vehicle to the mall where the revenge murder occurred? Let's take Doughboy for a minute. Doughboy's driving, right? Now, arguably, he's driving the vehicle. Ricky's in the back. If Doughboy had a change of heart and he got near the mall, is the fact that he has a loaded gun, he goes near the mall, and he changes his mind? Can you withdraw from the crime of attempt? That element, substantial step, close proximity. We see prosecutors all this be way too fast and loose with the AWIM charge, assault with intent to commit murder. It's just something we throw against the wall, and it's often put out there to plead down to a felonious assault. And the attempt is a broken crime, right? What do you do there? It's called incohate, so it doesn't actually become the principal or target crime. You gotta watch that. And the Boys in the Hood analogy always stuck with me. You know? If I had the complaint before me, and Trey's complaint come there, did he attempt to commit murder? Or did he leave before that substantial step was meant? And in a broad term, gets a lot deeper, right? But in a broad term, we're looking at an attempt. Was that a substantial step? Conspiracy is a whole different ballgame. Conspiracy is punishment in preparation for the crime. Did you want to commit the crime? Did you agree to commit the crime? Or did you do an act in furtherance of the crime? It doesn't merge. This really had its high point, if you would, in the 70s and 80s in Jersey, New York, and Pennsylvania. These were where RICO charges came into play. This is where the Pinkerton rule came into effect. Okay? But about conspiring, think about it. You're planning it, right? And what the legislation said was, there's punishment for the preparation, then there's punishment for committing the act itself. But conspiracy falls into an incohate crime because it's not actually committing the actus reus. The mens reus is the mental aspect. The actus reus is the physical aspect of things. Conspiracy doesn't merge for a huge reason. We'll go back to RICO charges against the mafia. We'll go back to the Pinkerton rule. In essence, what RICO and the Pinkerton rule wanted to do was they wanted to put everybody into a loop. When we say a loop, let's do stereotypes of the mafia in the 70s, okay? You got your guy who's bookmaking before FanDuel and all that good stuff. So you got your bookie, and you have your drug dealers, and you have your pimps. Then you have the guys that are loan sharking. Then you have the guys that are hiring people to commit murders. And whether you are the big player or the little bookie, in essence, you're part of this criminal enterprise. And the Pinkerton was like this big wheel. And what Pinkerton tried to do was, in essence, say that even the small-time player is conspiring into this criminal enterprise. So what did the prosecution want to do there? Well, they want to get the bookie and the pimp to roll on the murderers. And how did they do that? This is where RICO comes into play. If you're part of that circle, you could be charged with the principal crimes, even if you're in a low-end conspiracy. What does that mean in English? Let's break it down. Let's take the basketball game tonight. Celtics are given 8.5 points. Before the advent of FanDuel and all that stuff, you would call bookie. Give me 500 on the Celtics minus 8.5. The bookie's financing came from the drug running and the murdering. So what they would say is the bookie, who's got a wife and 3 kids at home, is responsible just as much for the murder as the guy that pulled the trigger. They all conspired in this criminal enterprise. What are they trying to do? Well, logically, the bookie didn't commit the murder, right? But the bookie's scared to death. So what they're going to do, prosecutor, not to use pronouns, the prosecutor is going to get the bookie to provide information on the drug runner. And the drug runner is going to provide information on the pimp. And the pimp's going to provide information on the hitman. And then everybody in the circle could face a prosecution, because technically they all conspire to commit this criminal enterprise. And that's why conspiracy doesn't really merge. There's times you can make plea agreements and sentence agreements to the contrary of that, but on the black and white law, conspiracy is a standalone crime. It's incohate, but it's standalone. And it's standalone because prosecutors want to get the bigger fish. The only way they could truly get the bigger fish was to garner testimony from the smaller fish. Hence, we have conspiracy, RICO, and the Pinkerton rule. All right, so solicitation, first pitch of the game. Attempt, the failed crime. Conspiracy, preparation for the crime, but not actually doing the crime itself. There are the three big ones. There's aiding and abetting. There's accessory after the fact. There's many others, but they're your big three. From a law school genre, from Michigan bar exam genre, from the MBE, the multi-state bar exam aspect of things, they get tested heavily. And in the real world, those three income hate crimes are the ones we see most frequently. All right, that's it for now. Have a good day, guys.
The proceeding was a paid presentation by McManus and Amadeo PLLC. Listeners of this program should contact their attorney to obtain advice with respect to any particular legal matter. No listener should act or refrain from acting on the basis of information within this program without first seeking legal advice from counsel in the relevant jurisdiction. Only your individual attorney can provide assurances that the information and your interpretation of it is applicable or appropriate to your particular situation. Listening to this program using any associated website or related links or resources does not create an attorney-client relationship between the listener and host, contributors, or contributing law firms. All liability with respect to actions taken or not taken based on the contents of this program are hereby expressly disclaimed. You and your loved ones deserve a criminal defense firm that believes that your life and freedom are worth fighting for. Matt McManus, Bill Amadeo, and the McManus and Amadeo team of attorneys, investigators, and case managers will take the lead with a vast knowledge and legal experience across the state of Michigan to get the best possible result for you. Learn more at McManusAmadeo.com. Schedule a free consultation 24/7 by calling 800-392-7311.